Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Georgia Popoff. Popoff is a community poet, educator, editor, and spoken word producer. She is the senior editor for the Comstock Review, a literary journal out of Syracuse, New York. She is the author of two poetry collections, Coaxing Nectar from Longing and The Doomweaver. Her third collection, Psalter, the Agnostic's Book of Common Curiosities, is due in the spring of 2015 from Tiger Bark Press. She is the co-author of a book for teachers and writers called Our Difficult Sunlight, a guide to poetry, literacy, and social justice in classrooms and community. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish. I'm glad to be here.
Now, I always want to know where poetry came from in your life. How did you discover it? When did you start writing it?
That's a great story I love to tell. I lived about a mile and a half from my school. I was just shy of the bus route, and I would walk back and forth. Most of the families in my neighborhood were Catholic, and they went to the Catholic school a block away. I went to the public school, and on my block, everybody else was on a slightly different time schedule. So I walked to school alone a lot, and I would make up little songs back and forth, and I remember distinctly the first time I recognized a metaphoric image in my head was in third grade, and I was coming home, and it was a terrible rainstorm. I was soaked to the bone, and we lived on a big hill that had recently been paved, and it was raining so hard that the raindrops were slamming into the water on running down the hill and bouncing back up, and it just looked like legions of ballerinas to me.
Ah.
And so I just started gathering my little poems. And in fourth grade, I was told by my fourth grade teacher a number of years ago, because she still was living in my neighborhood at the time, that I would just leave poems on her desk in the morning. Just kind of come in and leave poems that I'd written. And I wrote some plays for the kids to do in the backyard. And by the time I was in sixth and seventh grade, I was really identifying as a poet.
So that language grabbed you early. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's,
I had a very creative mother, though.
That helps. You know, that absolutely helps. So you were encouraged, I would assume.
Yes, very much.
Now, you call yourself specifically a community poet. Tell us what that means to you.
Well, when I went through a period of not writing in my 30s.
Mm-hmm.
I had been a creative writing major. I wanted to teach and write poetry and get married and have 2.5 kids and do all this stuff. Things got in the way. I had to drop out of school. I didn't get to finish my degree. I was scrounging for work. And I went through a crisis of faith during which I wrote very little. Mm-hmm. I basically say I wasn't writing it. Over that time period, I wrote about 23 poems that were negligible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when I came back out of the silence was right when the Poetry Slam movement was starting, and we were starting a team in Syracuse, and I saw Patricia Smith perform and said, oh, I got to do that. You can do that with poems? I want me some.
Yeah, it is. It makes it more like a drama.
Yeah, and it became, I jokingly call it my drug of choice, you know, slamming and being involved in that. In the early stages, mm-hmm. when it was still very small.
So that's your idea of community, that whole movement that started with Slam and more participatory. And
right. I was starting to do more. I was coordinating and curating reading series and doing special events, and I needed a business card. How do I identify myself? Because already things were starting to skew towards young urban hip-hop with Slam. Uh-huh. So I was aging out already. You know, I was 40. I was too old.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't fitting into academia because I didn't have a degree and I wasn't teaching. And I just didn't know what I was doing. But I was doing a lot in community, in workshops, events.
Hence the name.
So I decided to name myself Community Poet
and create
a post.
Yes, that's so great.
I've used that since. And I've heard that other poets are starting to use that same way to describe to themselves.
Well, I want to know what you thought that meant to you. Because to me it does mean that you're more part of the community and you're active and you're doing events and so on. Now you have a new collection coming out, as I mentioned, called Psalter, the Agnostic's Book of Common Curiosities. I love that title. Tell us where this book came from. What precipitated it?
When I finished The Doomweaver, that was the second book, that came out in 2008, and it was the second book of autobiographically rooted poetry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, me looking at the things that inspired me telling my story, me responding and reacting to the world, and relying on that for inspiration. And I had some poems that I had started that, number one, I was just tired of my own voice.
Mm.
I was current on my story. I was rather bored with my own story at that point and just simply relying on what hit me for inspiration, you know, the bolt of lightning. I wanted to go deeper in the craft. I needed to learn. I refuse complacency. And one of the things that I figured out was if I took all these autobiographical feelings that I had and these questions that I had about the universe and life and the meaning of things, and the answer's 42, according to Douglas Adams, you know, if I put it into the third person and investigated it from a character, I could be much more bold. It wasn't me.
That I find that very interesting.
It was great.
It freed you up, right?
It completely freed me. It completely freed me to go further into the metaphor, to go further into the question,
yeah,
and to make the character asking the question bolder. I mean, not that I'm not a bold person. People will know me. I'm wear my heart on my sleeve. You know everything about me. I'm rather flamboyant.
Yes, and you're very, very assertive.
Thank you.
I've noticed that.
I'm that too. But I could become, like, the questions could be bigger. And this book was going to be the next step from The Doom Weaver, which was really about what does a middle-aged woman or woman entering middle age, you know, all the questions that weren't answered, all the things that didn't happen, how do you fill the voids? So there were bigger metaphysical questions I wanted to mm-hmm. investigate.
Mm-hmm. This is a great book. I'm so excited that it's going to be published.
Thank you.
I was fascinated by the whole way that you organized it and the beginning questions, and yeah, it was very interesting. And I do want to have you read at least for now. I would like to have you read one of the first poems from Psalter. This is called "The Agnostic Strives for Love."
I'm glad and you
chose. Do you want to tell us a little
that.
Bit, or do you want to talk after?
Yeah,
you read it?
Let me read the poem first, and then this was the first of the series that really pushed me into the piece, and then I'll talk about it after. The Agnostic Strives for Love. Joy no longer believes in heaven. Her heart has shrunk, a tight blossom no larger than a caper. She no longer dreams of carding shiny coils into thick, dark yarn, twisting husband hair into long ropes. She will braid a clumsy ladder to climb through clouds instead, though her hands are knobby roots with precious little grip. Resolved to knitting gray scarves on number 10 needles, she has lost faith that sweetheart roses bloom deep within her.
I love that.
Thank you. I'm really attached to this poem.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about it.
This was the poem that I actually switched from first person to third person.
Ah, so this was really the beginning.
It really was. I had a few poems that late in the season of designing the book came into the collection. Originally, this was going to be a small chapbook length collection, and this poem, when I had the revelation that having a character I could do more with her, then I needed to name her, and I named her Joy. And there were a couple people when I first was showing some of these poems that said, "You can't do that. You can't call her Joy." And I said, "Yeah, well, I most certainly can." And the other reason why I like calling her Joy is that's the way Lucille Clifton always signed her books, and she's a tremendous influence on me. And I
had why do you suppose people said you couldn't use the word Joy?
They said it was too corny or too trite or too, you know, and I said, "No."
Oh, I thought they were more concerned with the sentiment.
Well, that too, you know, like, how can you call her Joy? Well, that's what her name is. She revealed it to me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was embarking on 8 years now of persona poetry. I'm just starting to go back to writing in my own voice because I have another book project, too. I have two other book projects. They started to unfold, and originally this was going to be a part of a book concept that I had. I was also working on a series of prose poems about conjoined twins. They're 200 words each, and the book was going to be like one of those training manuals that it's one language in one side and English on the other.
Oh, yeah,
and you flip
yeah.
it. So it would be Joy the Agnostic was going to be one chapbook collection. And the twins' poems were going to be another, and they were going to be united by a common theme of the last poem would be whoever the speaker of the poem was challenging God's mercy based on things like, you know, the creating conjoined twins and other deformities or disabilities. So how do we deal with that? I listen a lot. You know, I have my preconceived notion of what I'm working on until the piece or the work tells me, you got to go this other way. And about two and a half years ago, the project severed itself from being a conjoined twin. And the twins are kind of sitting there waiting to be written. I have about eight or nine of those now. And I started working on Joy the Agnostic.
And I have to ask you about, in the course of this book, you have an inside and an outside voice.
Yes.
Along with these, you know, they all start with the agnostic, blah, 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 blah. To tell us about the inside-outside voice.
That was such a great journey of discovery about what the work was teaching me. So I had all these poems that had these really, I mean, I wish I had kept every single title idea that I had, because they would just come like during the middle of the day, the agnostic, I'd be doing something, the agnostic washes dishes, the agnostic does this. You know, so it became these poems that were starting the agnostic dot, 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 whatever Joy would be doing. And I started to realize that, you know, I believe really heavily in the invisible reader behind the words is the way I teach it, way I hashtag it. We are so often committed as poets to our relationship with the poem. And I'm more interested right now in the poem's relationship with the reader and how can I enforce that. So I wanted a good read. And then one day, I was just thinking to myself, and I said, oh, you know, that sounds really great. What if Joy was thinking that? And I realized that I could have the third-person narrative about Joy, but then I could give Joy's view of what she was thinking. So those were her inner dialogue. I live alone, so I talk to myself a lot. So I started capturing these talking to yourself, and I just wanted to call them inside voice. Everyone, and they were... You're going to be kind of like a little sorbet between these heavy
and they're
poems.
In italics, just so people know,
They're in italics. Well, then one day I was having one of my inflammatory rants, which actually winds up in here, too. And it hit me, then there's Joy's...
Inner voice.
Her outer voice, her outside righteous indignation. So how can I indicate that? And I went, outside voice. I've done a lot of work in K-12 situations, so I know we have our inside voice and we have our outside voice.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So they're all in bold italics, and they're all called outside voice. And those are specifically designed as comedic relief through the book for the reader.
Uh-huh. It is. It is like a pause. It definitely is a pause.
And there was one more step that happened, if I can share that, is that I had this body of work about gardening and spirituality and Joy being an inflated me is gardening and knitting all the way through this book. So all of a sudden I realized that I could take all of those poems, which were about 8 or 10, and put them in and it could be Joy's first-person narrative. Oh. So there's the third-person stories about Joy, there's her first-person narrative, there's her inner dialogue, and there's her outside righteous indignation. And then I had ebbs and flows and peaks and valleys and variety to make the read better for
It's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating concept to me. Now, I do want to have you read another from Salter. This one is called The Agnostic Had an Early Start.
The Agnostic Had an Early Start. Joy is contrary. When small, she held audiences with spirits, private celebrations in garden corners. The adults thought she played well alone. She questioned everything, though rarely shared her curiosity. No stranger to disappointment, silence became her weapon, destiny a tin star topping the tree. Joy discovered both trust and magic among the dahlias. She took herself to church, sang alto in the junior choir, soon to realize she loved robes more than miracles.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Georgia Popoff. She's a community poet, and we are talking about a book that's due out next spring. It's called Salter, The Agnostic's Book of Common Curiosities. Now, you probably could have gone on and on with these, right? I mean, how did you know when this book was finished?
When it started getting too clever.
Ah.
I work on multiple projects at a time now. I don't just I'm not one of those people who says, oh, I'm going to write a book on so-and-so, and then I sit and, or, you know, I work on multiple poems at a time. I'm an avid revisionist. And so I've always got different things going so that if I get bored, if I start to run out of steam, I can turn to something else.
Oh, I see.
So I just stash things until I'm ready to look at the bigger picture. And 2 years ago in August, it was a really hot day. It was that summer that was so hot, and it was like 98 degrees, and I really didn't have to be anywhere. And I went out on my deck, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to sit down and see, where am I with this? How far am I?
Yeah.
And I hadn't added in the first-person poems yet. And I started just shuffling them around and putting them together in some kind of order, and I realized that I had a short book. It was a little bigger than a chapbook, but it was a little smaller than a full collection.
Yeah.
So that was really exciting to say, okay, now let's look at what it's going to take to finish this.
Oh, that's so fascinating to me. Now, how important is it for you to read publicly in order for a poem to have a complete cycle? Is that part of it?
Oh, absolutely. I heard Robert Bly say to a group of us one day, in the mid-90s, that a poem is never truly born until it's been given breath.
Yes.
And poetry is the art form that's intended to be taken both ways. Its tradition is oral.
Right.
It's laid in the world of the legacy and the lineage of poetry that it was written.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Although, actually, we can go back to Sumeria for that one. But for many, many years, you know, it was an oral tradition.
Yeah.
So it also, there's a difference between what you hear. When I'm reading, I honor the sentence in the reading. On the page, I honor the opportunity for the words to do the most. I really spend a lot of time in enjambment, that ending the line on a really key word that can even twist by the time my eye gets to the next line, can twist meaning and context.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So they are two different experiences.
Mm-hmm. But I find it really important to end poems with a strong line.
Absolutely.
Because it feels like poems are stories, and
right,
you don't want to leave people hanging. I mean, and that's how I feel about when I'm writing. I want a strong end line.
I think there's three critical parts of a poem.
Mm-hmm.
It's the title of the first line and the last line.
Uh-huh.
Like if you're flipping through a journal or a magazine or, you know, an anthology, you're going to stop at the title. You're going to stop at who the poet is.
Yeah, yeah.
So a great title will make somebody stop. I liken it to fishing. That's the bait. The first line is the hook.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
If the first line rewards the reader, they're going to read the rest of the poem. And the last line is the net. That's the audience member, if they have a strong last line, they're bound to remember the poem.
Yeah.
So you've attracted them, you've kept them. It doesn't mean that you don't have to do some work between the first and last line.
Yeah, yeah.
But the most memorable and crucial elements to me are title, first line, and last line.
Yeah, yeah. And I've often been so let down by last lines. It makes me go, why did you ruin the poem that way?
Right.
You know? Now, I want to talk a little bit about the fact that you're a co-author of the book that I mentioned in the intro, Difficult Sunlight, A Guide to Poetry, Literacy, and Social Justice in Classrooms and Community. To tell us what precipitated that book.
Our Difficult Sunlight was a long journey of conversation first with my co-author, Koresh Ali Lansana, who lives in Chicago and teaches. We were both teaching artists. We met when he was touring with Poetry Alive, which is a great group out of Asheville who for many years have been taking poetry into public schools. And he, as a younger writer, was touring with them. And it was 1995, I think. And by 1998, I was in a state with my own work that I was going back to teaching it in community and getting some school gigs, after school programs and this and that. So I started realizing pretty soon, especially once I was pretty committed. By 2000, 2001, I left a job as an office administrator and secretarial kind of editor thing to become a full-time poet. It's been a rocky road since then, but whatever. and there's so many miracles that were happening, but I also was seeing how many people are either missing the opportunity to use poetry in education or teaching it poorly.
Ah.
So we started comparing notes while Quraysh, in 2000, I think, he went to New York. He returned to do a graduate program at NYU to do his MFA. He was a father, family man, but moved mm-hmm. to New York to do that for his own career. And we were talking about our work as teaching artists a great deal. And then I decided to start writing some of the essays. And then I decided, well, this is a book project. And then Quraysh suggested, why don't we write the book together? Because we would bring, we have so many similar perspectives, but individual experience. He just turned 50, African-American, grew up in Enid, Oklahoma, but has lived a great deal of his adult life in Chicago. He studied with Gwendolyn Brooks and Haki Madhubuti. And at that time, when he finished his MFA, he was for 9 years director of the Gwendolyn Brooks Center at Chicago State University. And I am 61 next week, grew up in Syracuse.
So those two perspectives totally come together to talk about community, education.
Right.
I mean, yeah, and all that can be encompassed in poetry workshops. I've
seen
it.
Absolutely.
I've seen it happen. Now, before we run out of time, I want to have you read another poem.
Okay.
This one's called The Agnostic Prepares for Disaster.
All right. The Agnostic Prepares for Disaster. Joy cringes when night planes fly over the house. She was a duck and cover kid whose neighbors stocked bomb shelters with government-issue rations, alkaline batteries, and Peter Pan. She doubts tiny cans of corn and evaporated milk could stave off either fallout or starvation. Her disaster plan has dwindled to modest routines that accommodate benign tragedies, counting steps, bedroom, landing, ground, kitchen, sturdy railings on each side of the stoop. What is it like in the interminable dark? How does one decipher the braille of solitude? At night, lights off, she practices pouring water into containers, forefinger curved over the lip, anticipating the timbre of full.
I love these.
Thank you.
These. Well, why did you come upon the word agnostic to present these poems? Because once you read the poems, there's more certainty than question in many ways.
That was part of the evolution of the book.
Uh-huh.
They started out very much in question.
Uh-huh.
And it was this character saying, okay, in my immediate world, I see things one way, but we're just this... The best way to put it is the billboard I saw outside of Boston one year when I was driving on 95 that said it showed the Milky Way galaxy. It was for the science museum, and there was an arrow that went out to the slogan that said, "Hey, you, infinitesimal speck in the universe." And so Joy is contemplating all of that, but she also prays a lot. I mean, you know, agnostic is not atheist, so there's still that, you know, maybe not, show me. You know, Joy is asking the universe to show that there's something bigger that for her to understand and for her to have comfort in, that everything's okay.
Yeah.
You don't know, but everything will be all right.
And one wants to be alive if one can still question, right?
Yes.
It's the people who are certain. I think, aren't you bored with that certainty?
Right. That's a great point.
Now, I want to talk to you just a little bit about being one of the editors of the Comstock. What do you look for in poems? Because it can't be just your taste in your own stuff, right?
Right. That's really interesting. We are an all-volunteer organization, and there are, I think, 8 or 9 of us on the editorial board. So if you have submitted to Comstock Review, no fewer than 3 editors have looked at the work and made some kind of decision. And if you're published in the journal, usually 5 to 7 of us have said, yeah, we want it.
Wow.
And when I spent a short period of time, 5 years, as managing editor, so mine was the final decision. And one thing I'm looking for is, first of all, I don't want a poem that sounds like 15 other poems.
Yeah, yeah.
I want a strong first line. I don't want the strong first line to be the iteration of a strong title. I want it to move forward from the title. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I would like a poem that is more interested in the experience than what the speaker of the poem thinks about the experience.
Ah.
This is a big one I've been in my teaching, too. I teach at the Downtown Writers Center in Syracuse. and I'm also the workshops coordinator there. But and I see poem after poem that says, "I wonder if the sky was blue on the day I was born." You know, well, poets do nothing but wonder. You know, we rarely answer. We usually question,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's kind of redundant to say, "I wonder if." And I remember Ted Kooser saying, and we brought him to town a few years ago, and he was talking about first person being one of the key ways to take someone out of the poem. Yeah. Because you start thinking about, it calls more attention to the speaker of the poem and how they feel about it than the bigger picture behind it.
And letting somebody in to discover,
And it doesn't mean that you can't write in first person, but you don't have to say I at the beginning of every sentence, you know, that appears in the poem. There's so many ways to get past it and not state the obvious. So I'm looking for something that's a little, that takes risks in form or subject matter. I'm looking for, I'm clearly looking for quality language. You know, what my mentor, Lou Turco, drummed into our heads as young poets, heightened language, not big words.
And I, you know, the editor of the Healing Muse said that she looks to be surprised.
Yes.
She wants to be surprised.
Yes.
You know? Let's have you read a final poem from Salter. This one's called "The Agnostic Struggles with Gravity," and this is one of my favorites.
The agnostic struggles with gravity. She drops her hairpick, then her eyeliner, a crumble of toast pulled to the floor without warning. It's Thursday. Joy's knees hurt, and she tends to fall. This concerns her. Statistics of mortality after breaking a hip are staggering. She is not yet 60, but it is looming like a storm. She must change her perspective on calories, not units of taste, but fuel to burn as she navigates sidewalk cracks and loathsome stairs through this life, the earth beneath her pulling her back.
I love that. I love that. It's probably because we're both of a certain age, and it has to do with, you know, coming toward the end of the road. And speaking of which, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information?
Certainly. My blog is www.gappoet.blogspot.com. That's a great way to see what's going on in my mind. I've got a Facebook page. I've got a Twitter @gappoet. And look for the hashtag Poets Happy Dance. I've been sending out little inspirational messages on Facebook and there. And you can reach me in Syracuse by email at angel_light@earthlink.net. For anybody who's listening who might want to email me, you will hit my spam block. Do not panic. Just let me know why you're emailing me.
Well, Georgia Popoff, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Salter, The Agnostic's Book of Common Curiosities, and it's due out in the spring of 2015 from Tiger Bark Press. Thank you, Georgia Popoff.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.